This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. The 2021 United Nations Climate Change Conference held in Glasgow, Scotland, ended a couple weeks ago. World leaders gathered to discuss big plans to combat climate change and ultimately came to an agreement. Today, we'll talk about what that agreement looks like, how it works, and how Indiana fits into everything. Later, we'll talk to State Representative Carrie Hamilton about her experience attending the summit. But first, we're joined by Cliff Chapman, Executive Director of the Central Indiana Land Trust. Welcome, Cliff.
Yeah, good afternoon. Thank you.
Cliff, let's talk about this summit in Glasgow. What was it all about?
Well, you know, to be honest, I think like a lot of folks, when you hear about COP26, I had to look up what COP stood for. Because I think a lot of folks remember the Paris Accord or the Paris Agreement from a few years ago. But this is the 26th annual conference of the Conference of Parties. So it's really folks from all around the world, I think 200 countries this year got together to talk about climate change and what we can do as a planet to address the threats of climate change.
So this is separate from the other types of meetings that happen about climate change.
Yeah, this has been this is the 26th year for this. And I think this year, it just seems like year after year, we're getting more attention. I think here in the United States and Indiana, we're seeing climate change happening around us. And so if some of these COP conferences have happened in years past, maybe it kind of was a quick blurb on the news and we didn't really talk about it very much. And certainly this year's in Glasgow has gotten a lot of attention, and I think deservedly so.
Yeah, I mean, I can say that I also, when I saw the COP, and I was like, is it COPA? Is it a soccer tournament? Like, what is this? because, you know, usually it's very, very rare that we hear about this. So what was unique about this year's summit?
You know, I think one of the things that was unique this year was that the United States and China are actually finding a way to come together on the issue around coal and fossil fuels. And again, you know, I look at this both professionally, wearing a land trust hat, a nature conservation hat, but also personally. And, you know, from a personal standpoint, I mean, when representatives from 200 countries get together, it's going to be very high level. It's going to be broad strokes, but it's a big deal that China and the United States can actually find a way to come to an agreement, because I'm not sure that's ever happened before over the issue of coal, which is, of course, been very important to the United States in the past, still is today, but is probably even more so for China right now.
Well, let's talk about the agreement that made headlines about Glasgow that world leaders signed off on. What exactly is that agreement?
So I'm going to look at a few notes here. So it's about bringing down CO2 levels so that way we can really try to get to that limiting the average temperature around the world to 1.5 degrees centigrade. And, you know, it's really difficult to think in these terms because we're talking about these temperatures that's worldwide. And so, you know, when you think about what's 1.5 degrees centigrade and why is it a big deal? I know, you know, sometimes when if there's a big snowfall in Cleveland, they say, see, there's no climate change, but yet there's record heat in Australia. And that's how we have to think about that 1.5 degrees is it's all around the world annually. And so we're on a course now to pretty quickly go over that. And I think we're at 1.1 degrees centigrade up right now. And so capping at 1.5 is an ambitious goal. And the way to get to that is the CO2 emissions from fossil fuels. And I can later on in the program, I think we can talk about a little bit of maybe some things that weren't talked about that I saw. Certainly fossil fuels, CO2, but also trees and stopping deforestation. And from a conservation perspective, that really caught my attention. And again, these are broad strokes. These are large agreements with 200 countries signing off, which is a big deal. But how to police that is often where things get difficult. If there's sites or countries that say there's not going to be any more deforestation, but then there is 10 years from now or 5 years from now, what happens? And so that's where we have to think about this of where we're going as a direction, as the global community, and understanding there's going to be imperfections. Another thing that was agreed upon was to cut methane by 30% by 2030. And so methane is a greenhouse gas that is significant for climate change and part of the climate crisis we're in, but doesn't get as much attention as carbon dioxide or CO2. And so I think that was really important that all the leaders got together and talked about methane. Again, I think there was a lot of talk about coal. And I think that's one of the disappointments in the end is there were some last minute changes that, again, I guess for me, I'm not completely surprised when we're thinking this way and these and to get an agreement with 200 countries. But I think it was India kind of in the last hours of the conference to get to an agreement, changed a word in for coal to say that they were going to phase down the use of coal versus phase out coal. And that's significant. But I think countries like feel that they can phase out at this time. But, you know, like I say, this is, it's going the right direction. And that is exactly what we need to be able to do here in Indiana as well, is phase down and eventually phase out.
Do you think the agreement is actually something that can be implemented? I don't know much about how it's enforced. You know, is this like an honor code? It's symbolic. Everybody signed it. Or is there somebody going to monitor or some agency that's going to monitor whether countries are following through?
You know, I'm not sure if there's any way possible to make sure that all 200 countries follow through on everything they agree to. But I also think that that's a position for the United States to show leadership on. I sincerely hope that the United States is a leader in this and shows that we can follow through on the promises made.
I'm a little curious about how much damage was done to the environment just to attend the conference. Was it environmentally friendly, or did people have to take planes out there? Maybe I'm just being a little facetious.
honestly, if you just look up a little bit about COP26 and some comments that I've had in the last few weeks about issues around climate change, that seems to be the number one issue people bring up is if there were some world leaders that took a private jet to the conference and what was the carbon footprint of the conference itself. And, you know, I think that's something we all have to realize is to get to a better future and to do something good. We're not perfect in how we get there. And, you know, one of the things I think about with climate and climate change and climate mitigation is I don't live in a glass house. And, you know, when we start pointing at people that are doing this and doing that, I think we need to lead by example. And we need to understand that there's not a perfect way to get from A to B. And this is to get to where we need to go. It's going to be doing it through shades of gray and not in a black and white world. And so, yeah, if you get all these people together, there's a carbon footprint to the conference, of course. But is there a greater good? I believe absolutely yes.
You mentioned about 200 countries signed on to this agreement. Were there any countries that refused to sign, or did everybody seem to be on board?
You know, that's something I don't know if I can answer that as accurately or not. And that might be something better for Representative Hamilton later in the conference, but or in the call here. But I'm not aware of anybody that didn't sign on. I think that's why there had to be some agreements made, some negotiation there.
What are some of the challenges you think in getting people interested in global efforts like this one that the conference attendees were dealing with? Do you think the massive scale might be sort of overwhelming for people? You know, it's like, wow, this is a global thing and I can only focus on my own backyard.
You know, I think the only way we're ever going to make a global impact. And when I say we, it's a big we. The only way we're going to make a global impact is to work locally and to understand that our local decisions have global impacts. And that's where the things we do in Indiana can have impacts on the rest of the world, and other parts of the world have impacts on us. And so the Earth is a very small planet in a very big universe, and we need to take care of it. And we have to start locally to be able to do that. And if folks see that there's islands that are might disappear in our lifetime, I have to kind of put myself in the shoes of the people that live there and they're seeing the sea level rise and seeing the ocean getting closer and closer to their homes and where they've lived for generations. I can feel that. I can't put myself in their shoes, but it's a pretty scary thought. And I think we have to think about what we're doing in our own backyard and how that affects things globally.
Where does Indiana fit in with these global efforts or even local efforts?
You know, Indiana is in a very interesting position in the world, both politically and I guess you'd say ecologically when it comes to climate. On one hand, we kind of rank at the bottom of we're one of the worst polluters. Indiana is the second most industrious state in the United States, only after Michigan. So we have a lot of factories that use a lot of electricity, and we build a lot of stuff here. The largest percentage of land use in the state is agriculture. And much of that agriculture, over 50% of all of our corn, just goes into ethanol. And so we have to grapple with that we have hundreds of thousands or millions of acres of cropland that is not growing food, and it's just growing a commodity to burn in vehicles. And so from a policy perspective, I think we're kind of down towards the bottom in what we've been able to do. But on the flip side, if you look at where we are on the planet, weather patterns, water availability, soil types, we are positioned to be one of the best places on Earth for reforestation efforts and converting some of those ag lands back into forests and have some of the best impacts on the planet. And there's a mix of reasons why, and we're actually working on working with Purdue University to put out a white paper in fall of 2022 that we think will have all the data to support that statement.
And I know we're going to talk a little bit more later on about deforestation in detail, but we're going to take a quick break right now. We're talking about the climate summit in Glasgow and what leaders from around the world agreed on to fight climate change. Up next, we'll talk to an Indiana lawmaker who was there to find out what she heard. If you have any questions or comments for the show, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. Again, that's 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. We're talking about the many issues surrounding climate change and ongoing efforts to fight it both globally and here in Indiana. With us again is Cliff Chapman, Executive Director of the Central Indiana Land Trust. And we're also bringing in Carrie Hamilton, State Representative for Indiana House District 87 on the northeast side of Indianapolis. Welcome, Carrie.
Thank you, Miriam. So glad to be here.
We talked in the first segment about the summit in Glasgow and what world leaders agreed on. And you actually spent a week at the summit. What was it like being there?
I did. And it was an incredible experience to see people representing 197 countries come together for this cause of keeping the planet healthy well into the future by keeping our temperatures down. And also seeing the significant presence of global NGOs, the non-governmental organizations, and corporations that were there in a way, I think, probably different than in many past years, really working hard to be part of the solution. It was inspiring.
What did you make of the agreements that world leaders signed? Did you feel like enough was done at this summit?
Well, I can't say enough was done, but I do think we certainly kept the Paris Agreement alive, and there was a commitment. My sense is there was a commitment to continuing to work closely together, working hard towards the next year to go even further. So this was a step in the right direction with a lot of energy towards making sure the next step is even larger. And I think that's progress and something to be celebrated.
What does attending an event like this mean for you as a local leader? What is your role when you go there?
Well, I actually went, so my background is in the environmental field. I've worked in government and the non-profit sector and consulting, et cetera, for 25 years. And I actually was there on behalf of the climate tech company that I worked for. but I was also able to be there as a legislator, joining legislators from other parts of the United States and other elected leaders at several events throughout my week there. So I really had two hats on. And it was both hats were fascinating. So with the climate tech hat, to see this new and burgeoning sector coming to COP to be helped to be part of the solution, helping governments, helping the private sector to move the needle on carbon reduction strategies, was very empowering, and really important work that was there in full force. And then as a legislator, I was inspired by folks that I met from other parts of the United States, legislators who are doing really important work at the state level, work that we have not yet been able to tackle in Indiana, as we just haven't been willing, the powers that be have not been willing to take bolder steps. But to see how they're getting things done in other states and to bring some of those ideas forward in Indiana was something that kind of energized me heading into the next legislative session.
Well, seeing the impact of discussions and folks changing their minds at this conference, how were they able to do that? Did you get a sense for that and maybe using some of those techniques here in Indiana?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, one thing I mentioned that corporations had a major presence at COP, and also the global financial system. And the reality of the presence of both global corporations and the global financial system being at COP is that the world realizes we have an existential crisis to handle here. And so we need to shift our economy to address this crisis. You asked a question earlier of Cliff about flying to COP. Mm-hmm. And I appreciated that question, but it made me think of really a great tie-in to the overall reality of this COP, maybe compared to previous events, gatherings. And that is, this isn't about, we're not there to stop economic activity. The goal of everyone at COP is to change economic activity so that it produces less carbon. So we can still fly planes if our planes are operating with less carbon intensive modes and technology. Mm-hmm. Just like we're transitioning our economy right now to build electric vehicles for the future, as opposed to internal combustion engine vehicles. So it's about investing in the future economy. And that's exciting. And there's a business opportunity there for the world and for states like ours that, as Cliff mentioned again, are great manufacturing states. We have an incredible opportunity to grow and thrive as a state economically while being part of the solution to climate change.
I have noticed with regards to air travel, a lot of the airline companies will have what the CO2 emission is when you're going to go buy the ticket. Is that something new? Was that part of this agreement, or has this always been like that?
I think that's new amongst airlines. It's not necessarily part of the agreement, but that's a recognition by airlines that they need to start to offset carbon emissions, while at the same time, they know they need to be working on the technology to make flying more energy efficient. And that research and technology development is absolutely happening today. It's not the shortest road amongst technological innovations that are coming for carbon reductions, but it is definitely in progress.
If you have any questions or comments for our guests today, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All in Indiana, or leave us a voicemail with your first name and where you're calling from at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. We're speaking with Carrie Hamilton, State Representative for Indiana House District 87 on the northeast side of Indianapolis, and Cliff Chapman, Executive Director of the Central Indiana Land Trust. Cliff, this is a big picture question, and before we get into the details, how do you feel overall about where we're at on climate change?
Well, I think we have a long way to go, but I think we can make a difference. And that's something that motivates me every day. And so the big picture is the steps that we can take today and tomorrow, if we are going in the right direction, we can move the needle fractionally. And I'm a firm believer that in order to create positive change, it's going to be thousands of small steps or millions of small steps and not relying on someone else to make one big one for us. It's going to take a lot of us, but maybe not all of us, to make those small changes. And so I think just every single day we have to move the needle a little bit to fight the crisis.
That's a good point. I think some of us might feel like we want to give up if it's just us doing something. And then we notice like, wait, am I the only one recycling? And all my neighbors are just throwing stuff in the trash. Like, why should I even bother? But I guess it does make a difference in some way.
You know, and my wife and I, we moved in our house in 2015 where we are now. And the first week we moved here, we switched out. The previous owners had two trash cans and one recycle can. And we switched it to two recycles and one trash. And I had like five neighbors come over to me and noticed it and appreciated it. And we noticed some more recycling bins in the neighborhood after that. So it really can be just one thing that can affect five more people, and then they can affect five more people. And again, I am very imperfect. And when it comes to carbon, and I love eating cheeseburgers with red wine, and you know, I know that's not the best thing for the planet for me to eat, but it's pretty tasty. There are choices that we can make every day to move things in the right direction while also continuing to enjoy our lives.
Right, right. So maybe have your burger, but make sure you recycle the packaging.
Well, and certainly if we make them at home, we pay the extra money, we buy grass-fed beef. And, yeah. And that, to me, is a positive. That's something we can do positively. And in some ways, when it comes to the food we eat, it's like be a little bit more like our grandparents or great-grandparents. It'll help us out in several ways.
Carrie, what about you? How do you feel the trajectory is that we're on right now, where we're headed? I know earlier you mentioned it's still not enough, but are we doing anything positive?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I hearkening back to my comment at COP about having the financial system and the NGO system and the corporate system all at COP with those couple hundred governments, they're putting pressure on the governments. There's this growing universe of voices fighting for the change to happen, powerful voices. So I do feel overall very hopeful. I will say that I think Indiana is missing out on an opportunity to do more, both from just the perspective of ethically, I think we have to be doing more, we should be doing more. And then certainly, as I've mentioned, the economic opportunity that we could very well miss out on if we're not aggressively working to be part of the solution as the economy evolves.
You're reminding me of a show we did, I think, last week about solar panels being installed here in Indiana. Is that something that you see as one of the positive steps that we're going on here in Indiana?
Absolutely. You know, some great things are happening in the solar sector. And frankly, it's almost in spite of state policy. we have not been particularly proactive in supporting the growth of renewables in Indiana. But yet the market is telling us we need to move forward. So imagine if we put a little state support behind that market movement, we would see even more growth in that economic development. And then I'll just add to that, as a manufacturing state, the other thing we're not doing is working to see if there's an opportunity to build solar and wind panels in Indiana. Certainly we are now looking at the electric vehicle sector to make sure that we retool our auto manufacturing sector to build electric vehicles so that we don't lose those great jobs, but maintain them and maybe even grow them. Certainly we have an opportunity with other parts of renewable energy and technology, batteries, et cetera. So I'm going to be a little louder this year and working to encourage my colleagues to work together to be part of the solution and to support our economy to be part of the sustainability solution.
Cliff, when it comes to fossil fuels and being able to cut back, is one of the challenges just that there's too much money to be made in them, and that's why it's hard to switch over to something that might not make you as much money but might be better for the environment?
You know, I think there's always going to be money and influence there, but there's also just the fear of change and doing something because that's the way we've always done it. But certainly, you know, we at the Land Trust, we have several vehicles now. We have trucks our staff go out and manage our nature preserves and are doing important work for the environment, but we're driving either a smaller pickup with a V6 or a big pickup if we tow a tractor with a V8, and we're burning those fossil fuels to do that. And so I think, again, it's little steps that we can think about when we replace one of those trucks. There's a new, as far as I know, it's the first one coming out. There's a new Ford that's going to have a hybrid, a small pickup that's a hybrid. And that's something that we can switch into and kind of evolve into. But change is always kind of hard. But we're going to have to get off of fossil fuels for sure.
And Carrie, what do you think?
As
fossil fuels being a moneymaker and whether that's one of the challenges in cutting back.
Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you. Certainly. Yeah, well, again, as we've seen with the utility market here in Indiana and the energy grid, we're seeing a quick transition in many areas to renewables because it's actually more cost effective than fossil fuels, which we've subsidized in so many ways for so long. So I think the economics aren't going to support fossil fuels moving forward. But as Cliff mentioned, there's change involved. We do have to retool sectors so that we're building the cars of the future and the infrastructure of the future to handle clean grid and clean cars.
Carrie, when it comes to Indiana, how big of a role does the manufacturing industry play on climate issues here?
Oh, very significantly. A large part of our emissions do come from the manufacturing sector. Which means there's a significant opportunity there. As you know, we have a major steel manufacturing sector, for example. Well, in Sweden, they just produced the first batch of zero carbon steel on the planet. That's going to create a market niche for that product globally that Indiana could tap into if we were to choose to do so. So again, there's a real opportunity throughout our industrial sector to not stop being a manufacturing state and an industrial state, but to retool our industries to be clean and even more productive into the future.
How does one produce zero carbon steel?
That's a great question. I won't be able to dig into the answer because I'm not metallurgical scientist, but I do know it involves using green hydrogen power, and that replaces some of the coal-based energy coke products in the coal manufacturing or in the steel manufacturing process traditionally, and that is something that there's a lot of research around green hydrogen and the evolution of that fuel source globally will certainly be part of the climate change solution moving forward.
And, you know, I'll just add that up in Northwest Indiana, we're about to have the largest solar field in the United States.
Right.
I think it's 13,000 acres of solar panels are going into Northwest Indiana. And hopefully that can play a part of that because there's a lot of manufacturing up there.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. It was interesting. We had some of the folks with the solar panel company that are putting it in. And what I learned was they're not just putting the panels in, they're also going to be growing like native grasses and crops and things underneath the panels to make use of the land. And I thought that was fascinating.
It's terrific. I love it.
Well, Carrie, has manufacturing's role changed over the years? Do you think their impact on the environment has gotten better or worse?
Well, sure, definitely better. I think all industrial sectors over time have evolved in positive ways, but I do think there's an opportunity now to take bigger shifts, more aggressive shifts when it comes to carbon emissions. We've seen reductions in different toxins and in waste streams, but carbon is still a major product of Indiana's major industries. So that's where a real opportunity lies.
Cliff, what changes do you think need to happen in manufacturing for the environment to be better off?
You know, I'll back up a little bit. And one thing about manufacturing in Indiana and in the United States overall is we do have environmental protections and environmental regulations. And as Representative Hamilton has said, I agree 100%. We need to do better. We need to address the carbon emissions more than we are now. But we are currently doing more than a lot of other countries with not just carbon, but also waste and runoff. And I think it's, you know, if again, it's if we look at manufacturing and what they're doing in Indiana, we also have to look at the consumer and the decisions that consumers make and buying something local, buying something here made in Indiana or made in the Midwest or made in the United States is going to have a much smaller carbon footprint than buying something from the other side of the world that has to be shipped here. And so I think there's so many positives in buying local, whether it's not just talking about going to the farmer's market, but buying vehicles and buying things that our manufacturing sector is producing here.
That's a good point. Just I'm thinking for myself, the next time I buy something, I need to double check where it's coming from so I'm not putting on a long journey and polluting. So thank you for that. We'll be back after a quick break. We're talking about efforts to fight climate change. If you have any questions or comments for our guests today, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana or leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Back now to our discussion on climate change and how leaders say they plan to address it both locally and on a global scale. With us are two guests, Cliff Chapman, Executive Director of the Central Indiana Land Trust, and Carrie Hamilton, State Representative for Indiana House District 87 on the northeast side of Indianapolis. Before we get into the topic of reforestation, we do have a listener question from Martin on Facebook who asks, how much recycling in Indiana is actually recycled? The current concept of recycling in general is mostly a lie in terms of what is actually recycled. Cliff, would you like to start with that?
You know, I bet Carrie would be able to answer that better than myself.
Miriam, for 10 years, I ran the Indiana Recycling Coalition, and that was not too that long ago. So I'm glad to answer that question.
Yeah, absolutely.
The good news is that the vast majority of recyclables are recycled. We actually, in Indiana, have strong demand because of our manufacturing sector for the glass, paper, plastic, and aluminum products that are in our bins. Now, we do need to educate the public a little better about what can and can't go in the bins, because when it becomes highly contaminated with non-recyclables, that becomes a problem. But by and large, our material is getting recycled. If it's going into a recycling bin and being picked up in a recycling truck, the vast majority of it is recycled.
Well, just to go back to what you're saying about things that are contaminated, maybe are harder to recycle. So folks shouldn't treat the recycling bin as an extension of a garbage can. Maybe they should rinse out some of their plastic containers before they put it in there.
Absolutely. And then there are certain types of plastic films and material products that just can't be recycled. And so people need to go to their community website and find out what can and can't go in the bin.
Great. Well, thank you so much for that insight. And Cliff, let's talk a little bit about what your group does. Is there anything that makes Indiana unique related to the kind of work that you do?
Well, yeah, I would love to talk about that. Indiana is so much cooler than a lot of people give it credit for. And, you know, spending time out in California and in the West and hiking through the California redwoods, which are just majestic forests, but you can quickly learn all the plants there because there's only a handful of species underneath those giant trees. And in Indiana, we are just unbelievably blessed with biodiversity. And so the Central Indiana Land Trust owns a property in Johnson County that's 300 acres. And the state, we worked with the state of Indiana to do a botanical inventory for us. And they found 484 species of plants in that 300 acres. And now that compares with some national parks that are 200,000 or 300,000 acres in size with fewer species. This is 300 acres in Indiana. We grow trees well and fast, and our forests are unbelievably diverse with perennials. And that's one of the important things to think about with climate change and nature, is having a landscape dominated by perennial plants versus a landscape dominated by annual plants. And if we think about carbon sequestration and how forests and how wetlands and prairies play an important role with that, is they are breathing in that CO2 and breathing out oxygen, which we need as humans. And when long-lived perennials, they are storing that carbon for decades, if not centuries. With annual plants, even annuals that are in a forest, or annuals like our most of the food that we eat, and for livestock feed, they sequester carbon for the year. But when they're harvested, all the CO2 is released back into the air. And so there are our forests are not necessarily unique in Indiana, but we are part of the country and part of the world with central southern Indiana, central southern Ohio and Illinois, Kentucky, and parts of Tennessee, that we actually, these forests actually sequester more carbon than any other part of the nation. And the other thing to think about with Indiana forests, and again, you have to kind of think a little bit here, but in the winter, you know, snow is coming, right? It's December 1st, snow is on its way, and we mostly have deciduous forests. And so when we get a snowpack in the winter, that snow reflects sunlight, reflects heat, and keeps our winters a little colder. Where in other parts of the country and the world where we have evergreen trees, it's darker, it's darker green, and it absorbs the heat. And so to reforestation as a tool to combat climate change isn't equal around the world or even equal in the United States. And so where we are here in Indiana, this is one of the best possible places for reforestation.
Carrie, have you worked on any legislation related to reforestation?
I have. And I'd actually like to, first I want to thank Cliff and Central Indiana Land Trust for the important work they do. And that was just a great synopsis of why your preservation work is so incredibly important from a outdoor recreation and natural preservation perspective, but certainly from a climate change mitigation perspective. Miriam, I would love to talk, kind of widen this out just a little bit and talk about a conversation that I'm hoping will finally kick off this year. And that is to create a climate change mitigation and resilience commission at the state level. We have never in Indiana had a statewide conversation that broadly discussed all of the issues related to climate change for our state, whether it's industrial, agricultural impacts, direct community impacts and equity around climate change, certainly carbon sequestration and natural conservation issues. We have incredible expertise with our universities, as you know, because I know you've interviewed a lot of folks from both Purdue and IU that are working on climate change. And to really come together and have a conversation about how we can support the important things that organizations like CILTI are doing, and also work again to retool industry to make sure we're protecting our communities and our most vulnerable populations from the effects of climate change.
We have two listener questions somewhat related about trees and reforestation, but I'll start with the first one. We have a question from Craig on Twitter who asks, corporations tend to focus initiatives towards tree planting programs. Can you touch on the advantages of preservation versus tree planting programs as it relates to climate change?
Yeah, there's an article on the WFYI website today about wetlands and preserving extant or, you know, existing wetlands versus creating new ones. And it could take 10 to maybe even 100 years for a newly created wetland to sequester carbon in the same way as protecting like a natural area that's a wetland. And so, as I was saying before, one of the best things we can possibly do is protect existing high quality or diverse forests, prairies, and wetlands. And again, in Indiana, we have some amazing examples that are still out there that are privately owned. They're unprotected and could be cleared. So again, that's one of those things where every single day there's an opportunity for us to protect something that's evolved over thousands of years and could be destroyed in a single day.
We have a question from Miles on Facebook who asks, in Carmel, we're organizing to plant 10,000 trees. Can a movement like this happen statewide?
Well, I would say yes. And a couple of years ago, when the Central Indiana Land Trust announced that we were going to plant 1 million trees, Governor Holcomb heard about that and put it in the State of the State address in, well, it seems like it was so long ago, but it might have been January of 20. Seems like that was 10 years ago now. But just in January 2020, the governor announced that the state of Indiana was going to plant 1 million trees. And I think if the city of Carmel is planting 10,000, then that is something that can catch on. And it really benefits all of us, the more that does catch on.
Hey, Carrie,
Go ahead. I was just going to add to that from Miles from Carmel that absolutely, in addition to what Cliff said, we can, you know, looking forward as part of that, a broad statewide climate change conversation, that would be a key component, both tree planting and tree preservation of existing, for example, old growth forests and state forest land that might otherwise be under threat of logging.
Harry, I was going to ask you sort of in light of that, do you think that tree planting programs or things when we hear about these initiatives are more for public perception versus, I mean, do these things actually go through? Do we see these trees getting planted when we hear like 1 million trees or 10,000?
That's a great question. So when done well, there are absolutely high quality tree planting programs. And I'm sure Cliff could speak to this, where we have to make sure that the trees are planted in a smart way in the right locations, that they're watered appropriately for the amount of time they need to be managed, and have a long-term plan to keep them thriving. Without those steps beyond just putting a seedling in the ground, tree planting initiatives often don't work well. But I think the folks that are involved in these efforts today understand that for the most part and are doing really smart, thoughtful tree planting programs.
Yeah, and I can say for the tree planting that we're doing, we are actually doing it. And we have, beyond situations where you might have had a grant as part of a purchase of a property and then some dollars to restore it, we have a carbon calculator on our website. And we have several people that every time they take a trip, every vacation they go on, they come in after that and they plug in their miles that they flew and the miles that they drove. And we separate those dollars that they make as a donation, and those turn into trees in the ground. It basically how many miles turns into how many trees that are planted. And we monitor those and make sure that not only the trees that we planted stay alive, but then in time, especially if we're converting a site, that the forest will take off and the forest will stay alive. Because certainly the trees that we plant are only going to be a fraction in 20, 30 years from everything else that will come up in that forest. And with the state of Indiana, we have been communicating with the Division of Forestry. And by the end of this year, I think they've planted 440,000 trees on state forests as part of that pledge the governor made last year.
Wow, that's a lot of trees. And what I'm wondering, too, is when there are tree planting programs, is there an effort made to figure out whether these trees are going to be an environmental help or are they just ornamental? Because I feel like sometimes when new buildings come up and there's landscaping done, it's random trees that aren't even native that may not really have much other than looking nice.
Yeah, certainly for what we're doing and what the state's doing is we are mirroring the species that we're planting next to. So, and we don't plant in random places. We don't just look for an open field and try to buy it and plant trees. We have a conservation plan with sites that are very high quality sites. And so next year, our main tree planting is going to be in Shelby County on an addition to our Meltzer Woods Preserve. It's an old growth forest. And so the trees that we purchased, the seedlings that we purchased that we're going to plant with a tractor and tree planter mirror the species that are already there. And the one caveat we put to that is we're not introducing anything new to the area. But if we look at ranges of species, we are trying to think about climate change and we do that. And because at the end of the day, we accept that climate change has started. This isn't this specter in the future. We're living in it right now. It's just we're going to do everything we can to mitigate the effects of it. But when we're looking at the species to plant, we're not going to plant something that's at its northern limit in Shelby County because those trees might not survive. So we're planting things that we know will, our best understanding will have a chance at survivability. So at that site in Shelby County next year, I think we just purchased about 20,000 trees that are going to go in.
Carrie, when it comes to climate change, there's been talk for years about how politicized this topic has become, especially here in America. Do you see that division in our state house between Democrats and Republicans?
I certainly have. Two things I'll mention to that. First, I think with the extreme storms and heat, these deadly events this past year, I think denialism is pretty much not present anymore at the state house. Now, is there a concerted effort to move forward and be proactive? Not quite yet, but I think we can get there. Maybe not as fast as I like, but we can start to make progress. I do want to share, Miriam, that a year and a half ago, I reached out to some colleagues across the aisle and created the Indiana Trails Caucus, the Legislative Trails Caucus. And we're working to expand trails and bike and pedestrian connectivity across the state. And it is the most bipartisan work I've done in my 5 years at the State House. It's urban and rural, Republican, Democrat, from all types of communities across Indiana, aligned to help build out that connectivity. And we come to the table for different reasons. There are significant quality of life, public health, and economic development benefits of making these sorts of connections in our communities and building greenways that were once rail beds, for example. But there are also certainly carbon mitigation benefits to this work as well. So the more we can kind of make those broader arguments that connect with smart carbon reduction strategies, the more successful we'll be.
Cliff, what are your thoughts on public discourse right now around climate issues? What are you sensing?
I guess what I think about this is what we often hear the most are folks from both extremes when it comes to these big issues like climate. And again, I think a lot of people feel overwhelmed by it, and I strongly advise them to not, that we can all make a difference in a small way. But the to me, the situation is there's folks that say it's a hoax, there's nothing to it, this is just a normal pattern on Earth, and so deal with it. It's not human caused when we know it is. And then on the other extreme, there's folks that would say, we shouldn't wear leather shoes. We should only eat vegan, and we, don't use your air conditioner. Go to such an extreme that there's hardly anything we can do that we feel like is a normal part of our lives that we're used to. And so I really believe that where we're going to make a difference is going to be somewhere in the middle, and it's going to be a little bit less and for some and more for others. But that's how we're going to make a difference, is accepting that it's real, and some making really big changes and some making small changes, but everybody pitch in.
Well, we're going to get ready to wrap up here. And before we do, Carrie, is there anything climate related you're looking forward to in the upcoming legislative session?
I do hope that, as I've talked about, we realize that global economy is evolving to be a low carbon economy, and that we can get on that train and be part of the solution and help our state thrive economically and from a community health perspective or not. And I think this is the year, the first time I feel hope that we can start to really work together and move in the right direction. Again, not quite as much as I'd like. As Cliff mentioned, though, I think we can make some progress.
Well, thank you to both of you for joining us this afternoon. Cliff Chapman, Executive Director of the Central Indiana Land Trust, and Carrie Hamilton, State Representative for Indiana House District 87. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our Managing Editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. If you want to reach out to us, ask a question, leave a comment, you can find us on Twitter and Facebook at All in Indiana, or you can leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Soeb. Thanks for listening. This is All In.